I think there's another person or two dribbling in. I was just trying to decide which is worse, to be after coffee break or before lunch. So they put you in the middle of things here. But that's good. It's fun to see the buses leave and sad at the same time. So that's sort of what's on the mind. We take off today as well. My name is John Jensen. I have gotten to know many of you this week, but not all of you. And to those of you who've come to multiple sessions, thank you. Maybe it's a sign of a weak mind that you keep coming back again. I don't know, but I've certainly appreciated it, and I have learned a lot. I know that I talked to lots of people about how wonderful it is to, in some sense, be a student again in this fantastic educational setting. But I also just want to say it's a fantastic place to be a teacher, because I mean, it is the best thing about teaching, that you're always learning, and it's an amazing place to be in that regard. I want to talk a little bit this morning about sustainability, and for me this week it's sort of the hardest one to prepare for, because it's what I do the most work on. And so figuring out what you want to talk about or where you want this to go is the challenge that's there. But I'd like to start with our summer's theme, which has come back in different places at different times. The Bible verse that's there, rich with its own history, but I just want to use the imagery as our starting point for this morning. So where the river flows, life abounds. I'm a river person. I love rivers, but I also find that for almost everybody I've ever met, rivers have a tremendous power. And I want to start with that image. I'd like you to do something for me. I'd like you to picture a particular river and a scene on a river, if you would. So take just a couple of moments. Close your eyes, and I'd like you to picture a scene somewhere on a river that you know well. Maybe it's here on Railroad Creek at the bench that is up the way. Maybe it's a river where you grew up and played as a kid. Maybe it's a favorite vacation spot that's out there. But just take a few minutes, close your eyes, and picture a flowing river in a particular place that is special to you or memorable for you. You can open your eyes again, what I'd like you to do is, with a person that's next to you, just take a moment and share that image of where it is or what sort of sticks in your mind with that image. And then I'd like you, after you've each had just a minute to sort of share where this place is that sticks in your mind, just to think of words that flowing river evoke for you. What is it that brings to mind in thinking about a flowing river? Just with another person next to you, share that image and also the words that come along with it. I'm going to go to the next one. What are some of the words that you associate with that? I'm just curious. What comes to mind when you sort of think of that image? What
are
dams. Some dams, okay.
Floods.
Roaring floods.
Rushing falls.
Rushing. Mm-hmm. Powerful.
Powerful.
Meandering.
Mm-hmm. Refreshing.
Just moving water.
Mm-hmm. The moving, the constant movement.
Contentment.
Contentment.
Muddy.
The big muddy of the Missouri is...
A very efficient system of moving water.
Mm-hmm. Always there.
For me, I am a canoeist. That's my passion. I love kayaks as well, but canoes are what's there. So when I think of these river images, what came to mind most for me, well, one in particular that I was thinking about, but a whole series. When I went to graduate school in Colorado, I had just finished a summer canoe trip to Hudson Bay. I had spent 6 weeks sitting in a canoe, watching what went before me, sort of living the life of the river that was there. And I showed up in Denver, Colorado, in a dry, barren, seemingly godforsaken place at the time. Beautiful in its own way, but very different that was there. And during the time that I spent in Colorado, though, I fell into a job, as we often do. And one of the fun things about Holden, I think, is hearing people's stories and how often we sort of fall into things along the way. But I fell into a job as a river guide. So I spent 6 years that I lived in Colorado leading canoe trips in western Colorado and in Utah, etc. And we did a whole series of rivers that I spent lots of time sitting by, watching the river go by, along with other things there on the Colorado River, the Gunnison River, the Yampa, the Green River, the White River, the Dolores. Big flowing rivers that go through dry country that really do sort of define the life that's there. Where the river flows, life abounds. That is particularly true, I think, in arid regions like that. I fell in love with those rivers, and that was, for me, an incredibly sort of healing place that was there. All of those rivers are tributaries of the Colorado River, the mighty Colorado, which so much defines a certain part of the Southwest along the way. And there's an amazing amount of life that goes along with that. But there's also a tragic story with the Colorado River, as there are in so many other places. The Colorado River runs dry prior to making its way to the ocean. Given what has happened with human use of that water, which so much gives life to agricultural crops and other places, the mighty Colorado River now runs dry prior to finding its way to the ocean. Although Leopold, in his seminal book, Sand County Almanac, talks about visiting the delta of the Colorado and this amazing place that it was, and then saying you should never go back again because it's not the same place. For me, this is what sustainability is about. I will give you some definitions, I'll talk more about it, but it's about the twin factors that rivers, for so many of us, are this incredible image, a powerful image that at times of floods and other things are destructive, but also this incredible life-giving image that is a river. But at the same time, if I think about the case of the Colorado and what has happened to that, with the fact that we, in a sense, have used it up, and that what happens at the delta in the Colorado, that's also what sustainability is about. It's the challenge of sort of saying to ourselves, how do we understand that life-giving power that is in a river, and how do we so arrange ourselves so that that life continues as it goes forward from there? I now live closer to the Upper Iowa River, very, very different than the Colorado River from there, but it has its own similar story. As it flows past our campus, as I float in a canoe, the power that's there, the life-giving thing that's there is amazing. But what you don't see there is what's in the water and what goes down as the Upper Iowa flows into the Mississippi and the Mississippi flows downstream. It's certainly not a story of the water being used up. But if you look at what happens in the Mississippi by the time it makes its way to New Orleans, it has been so sort of corralled, such an attempt to kind of control that river by humans. And as it flows out into the Gulf, sort of full of fertilizers in particular, it creates a huge dead zone that's out there. This life-giving thing that I think is so powerful for us, but so powerful the land, creates a dead zone. In the Gulf of Mexico as a result of what is in that water along the way. So for me, that's the starting point. What is sustainability about? It's the life-giving power of rivers, but understanding the challenges that are involved in getting a right relationship between humans and the more than human world, and between and within human communities as we go forward from there. I want you to do one more thing in small groups, and then we'll get into it a little bit more. I think another place in starting to talk about sustainability is with simple questions. What sustains us? And also, what sustains life along the way? I think that most people, when they come to Holden Village, in some ways they feel more alive than they do at any other time, and they feel sort of more connected from there. What I'd like you to do is take just a couple of minutes, again, with a partner, whoever you are with from there. These are big questions, but what sustains you? And what sustains life? As we're thinking about sustainability and what it is that we're sustaining, I want you to spend just a couple of minutes talking about that. Then I want to dive into some definitions and take us into some other places from there. But what sustains you? What sustains life? What comes to mind when you hear those questions? Let me have your attention back up here if I could, please. Let me sort of dive into some other things and we'll return back. I just wanted you to start with those questions in terms of what sustains you and what sustains life, and we'll return back around to that again. Let me talk just a little bit about the concept, and then I want to get into some of the challenges that sustainability brings about for all of us along the way. There is, as with almost anything in academia, there are long debates and fights about definitions of sustainability. I find these to not be particularly helpful along the way, but it is essential that we know what we're talking about. And let me just say a little bit about some of that and then getting into some more details related. Certainly the most cited definition of what sustainability means goes back to what's called the Brundtland Commission, which was looking at sustainable development and defined sustainability as meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. Meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. There are some different pieces of that, I think, that you can sort of unpack. There is always, I think, an inherent social justice component to the concept of sustainability. Sometimes it gets left behind. Sometimes, and I'll talk about energy issues in just a minute, it's seen as all about climate change or all about energy. But there is sort of built into that this notion that it's about the ability for all of us to sort of meet our basic needs. But the biggest component of it, I think, is this sort of future orientation. Are we doing things in such a way that we are making it impossible for future generations to be able to meet their needs? So we often think of it in terms of scarce resources. What happens if we use up all the oil? What happens if the water that is flowing in a river like the Colorado or that is in the Ogallala Aquifer is used up in such a way? What's the impact on the future generations from there? So I would suggest to you that at the very core of the concept of sustainability is this forward-looking or future orientation. Almost anybody that I've heard talk about sustainability at some point comes around to talking about children. And I'm going to do the same thing. I think there is this sense of sort of looking ahead. And we have a society that tends to be fairly short-sighted, whether that is in our businesses focusing on the next quarterly and what the profit reports are from there, or we get constant statistics in terms of what's happening to unemployment rates right now. Rarely do we ask the questions about future generations. Are we doing things now that sort of compromise the ability of future generations to meet their needs as they go forward from there? So sometimes for some folks, this is all that it is. Sustainability boils down to nothing more than the old concept of, say, looking ahead 7 generations or looking ahead to the next generation and say, what are the impacts of what I'm doing now from there? And so it comes down in that way. And I have a colleague who says that for whatever you do, you should ask, can we do this for all people for all time? That essentially that's what sustainability is asking. Is my lifestyle, am I living it in such a way that it could be for all people for all time? The answer is clearly no for my lifestyle. I don't know how you all live, but it gets us at the fact that usually when we're talking about sustainability, people are talking at least as much about unsustainability, about things that can't be sustained, as they are in sort of looking at that future orientation. The other thing that comes out of that definition that that we talk about a lot is what some people call the triple bottom line, that there is 3 realms of the environment, economy, and a sort of notion of social equity, and that really sustainability is about trying to bring together or looking at the intersection between environmental issues, issues of a sort of sustainable economy over time, and issues of justice or social equity. That if we find that place where we're in harmony with the environment, where we have an economy that can be sustained over time, and we're achieving social equity, that there's some sort of a sweet spot that is within that along the way. That notion of a 3-legged stool, or in business it's often called the triple bottom line, that it's not just about the money, but understanding the environmental effects and the social equity that goes along with it is often a piece of what's there. So if you think about it in terms of we live in the presence of the Holden mine, the majority of hard rock mining is done in other places these days. It's done primarily for profit. What does it mean to ask about doing a mining operation in such a way that it is economically sustainable, but also minimizes any sort of environmental harm, particularly long-term harm, and takes seriously the local community that is impacted? Much mining these days is very much exploitive of local rural communities where that takes place, whether that's in Africa or South America.
Well, when you mentioned the Colorado River, obviously we haven't done very well for the Colorado River, considering it as sustainability.
Right, yeah. I mean, so the idea is we maybe get ourselves sort of fully in here, and instead what we need is, instead of one bottom line, kind of a triple bottom line along the way. Let me draw the same sort of three circles, but in a very different way, which is another way of sort of getting at perhaps things in a different way. We tend to think of things almost exclusively, at least in a business and oftentimes in a policy terms, in terms of the economy. But what happens if the economy is located inside of a circle that is society, where we're thinking about equity as a key piece of that from there, that the economy in some sense is not this independent thing, but the economy is a human creation. It's a wholly owned subsidiary of our community. And is it serving in the way that we want? And ultimately, isn't it the case that all of that, our society as well as the economy, is dependent upon this thing that we sometimes call the environment that is out there, those natural resources? What sustains us? Just listening to some of the conversation, we are sustained by community, by a sense of spirituality, but in a very direct sense, we're sustained by having healthy drinking water. We're sustained by having good air to breathe. We're sustained by having the soil that's necessary to grow the food that we need, to have those sorts of conditions that are there. Sort of understanding the relationship between different elements of our existence is an important piece of this along the way from there. And so two different ways of getting at the same thing, but understanding that it is a multidimensional concept. That sustainability can't be simply about environmental issues, but we can't ignore those as well, and trying to understand the relationship between those different pieces along the way. For me, though, sustainability is best understood not so much as some definition, meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs, or it's the triple bottom line of the environment, economy, and equity, but more as a tool that we can use in looking at our own lives, at our institutions, and other things from there. I like to think of sustainability as a lens and also as a vision. And this comes back to starting with an image of rivers along the way from there. That sustainability can become sort of a way of asking questions in the way that I said before. With anything that we do, can I keep doing that? Could it be for all people, for all time, from there? That ultimately, it's about, that keeps asking questions. How is it that if I look at this, not simply through, is this good for me? Does it make sense now? But what are the long-term implications of doing this? What are the broader sort of sense of what's out there? But it's also a vision of a different world. I think of sustainability as perhaps being closer to justice. Maybe it's because I'm a philosopher, and going all the way back to Plato and beyond, people have been arguing about what is justice. But it doesn't stop us from sort of recognizing that there's a vision of a just world that we want to work towards. And that ultimately we can use justice sort of as a lens through which to evaluate different practices along the way. And ultimately, I think both of these things, seeing it as a lens, as a perspective through which to look at things, is this sustainable? Is this something that can be continued? Ultimately push us in terms of a series of questions as we begin to think about it from there. And that's what I'd like to move towards, is thinking about this notion of a kind of a long-term perspective, and thinking about the fact that through the lens of sustainability, so much of what we do is not currently sustainable. One of the ways that I like to think about this is in terms of different areas to look at, and ultimately in terms of big questions that we need to answer from there. So I want to shift just a little bit in thinking about this in a more specific way, but also in a kind of big picture sort of way to think about what we might call a series of grand challenges. What I don't hear much debate about is the fact that the way that we have organized ourselves as a society, the way that we are living now, is fundamentally unsustainable. Something has to give when we think about that. And the problem sometimes is it's totally overwhelming to even think about how we begin to go about doing that. And I want to break it down to the smaller scale, but I do think it's important to keep in mind sort of the huge scale of what are these grand challenges. And I think there are a lot of them. And they're all interrelated, but at the same time, if we can sort of break some of it down a little bit, I think it's helpful along the way. So let me say just a little bit about a few of these and how I think we can frame these. And then I want to move into the realm of what is being done or what can be done and begin to think about it from there. Grand challenges. To me, it's not they're not insoluble problems, although they often seem like that along the way. But we do need to think big. We need to think about these things in very large terms, but then also begin to figure out how we can work on a smaller scale to figure it out from there. In my way of framing this up, the way that I like to think about it is with questions that go like this. What will it take to blank from here? And not can we do it or how do we address this, but sort of assuming that we start from the fact that we have to meet these challenges, but what will it take? Let me run through a few of them along the way. And there are different ways of seeing it. Climate change is a real thing. It is going very quickly in directions that make it a little bit scary along the way. But I think ultimately if we can frame the questions up in the right way, we get better off from there. Yeah.
Who are you directing this to? Individuals or government or industry or...
Yes,
yes, and yes. So I'll come back and talk about it in just a minute because I think part of what we need to recognize is that there are different levels for thinking about this, but there's no one magic level in which it needs to be worked at. What I'm doing right now, the way I think about it is directing it to each of us as individuals, but each of us as members of communities and members of organizations along the way.
So frustrating.
Yeah. And I think we have to figure out where are the places that we can do things that ultimately come out of it from there. So let me frame up the grand challenges and then come down to the more specific levels of what we might be able to do from there. For me, the way that I think about this grand challenge is to say, what will it take to wean ourselves off of coal and oil in the coming few decades? We sometimes frame it up in terms of the amount of carbon emissions that are out there, etc. But the heart of the matter, I think, for us is getting ourselves off of coal and off of petroleum. And I think getting ourselves basically completely off of those and doing it in a time span of decades, not of centuries from there. How are we going to do that? Well, we don't know. But we have to figure it out. And we need to ask questions that sort of say, what will it take in order to make that happen from there? And Let me hit several of them because I think it's important to see it in the bigger picture. I did these as pairs, although they can be framed up in lots of different ways. Food and water. Food is a huge deal for those of us, and water is a more localized issue. But I think we still haven't done enough to recognize, even in those arid places where we think about it, we still use the vast majority of our water to grow food. And we've got to kind of figure out how we bring those things together from there. What will it take to make sure that everyone in the world has enough to eat while doing it in a way that regenerates soil and water, protects biodiversity, and ultimately enlivens agricultural communities? What we have been doing is growing more food-like substances while destroying soil and air and species, as well as destroying a lot of the communities that go along with it. What will it take to make sure that everyone has enough to eat, but doing it in a regenerative way? For technical terms here, waste and stuff. We are the people of stuff these days. We buy stuff. The amount of waste that is generated by every citizen in America is astronomical, and we buy that stuff along the way. What will it take to dematerialize our culture and radically reduce the stuff that chokes us and the waste that results? What will it take to achieve that sort of grand challenge along the way? These are not just environmental. I don't think we can address these, nor is it the challenge of where we are to do that. Inequality and poverty are sustainability issues. They're grand challenges that we need to figure out how to meet along the way. What will it take to eradicate extreme poverty, level out inequalities, ensure that all people have the means necessary for meaningful lives along the way? And I want to put one more up and then move beyond what might seem like pie in the sky into individual pieces of it as we go forward. I think of peace and diversity as another grand challenge for our society. What will it take to live in peace with each other and the more than human world and halt the dramatic loss in biological and cultural diversity that characterize our time? When people look at it, there's a fairly clear correlation between loss of biological diversity and loss of cultural diversity, and arguably they are the same causes along the way. What will it take? There are no easy answers. And I didn't come here to offer any answers whatsoever. Maybe it's maddening, but I think we need to raise the questions, and we need to understand the scope of those questions. We need to understand that these are the grand challenges of our time. I'll say a little bit more in terms of, I think the time frame that I like to think about is between now and 2050, sort of thinking ahead from there. It's interesting, I think, for Holden Village celebrating the 50th anniversary of this village to look out another 50 years from there. Now, many of us, maybe most of us, will not be alive in 50 years. But the same was true of people when they started Holden Village at that time from there. And having that sort of far-sighted vision and being able to sort of think about this in terms of the grand challenges that are there. But we have to ask these questions. We have to sort of live them along the way from there. And then we have to devote the resources and the people in order to do it from there. I've spent a little bit of time this week reading a book called Reinventing Fire. By Amory Lovins, the physicist that works at the Rocky Mountain Institute in Colorado. And basically what that big, thick book that I don't necessarily recommend to you, but it's fascinating. They have spent the last decade, roughly, with a team of researchers, some of the best and brightest in this country, trying to say, in very specific terms, what would it take to get ourselves off of fossil fuels by 2050? They're counting on some natural gas in that picture, but they have very specific plans in terms of what it would take for our society to get there. They outline what the business opportunities are, the profits to be made in doing that, but ultimately eliminating coal and petroleum and cutting back on our natural gas usage as a way in order to do that. It can be done. And I think with each one of those grand challenges, although they seem it's frustrating to think about, and they seem impossible along the time, it's because we haven't focused our energy in the way to do that. We ask ourselves questions, not us here, but as a society, we ask ourselves questions. It's like, how can I make more money? How can I create jobs? You know, cleaning up the Holden Mine is a tremendous job creation, and I'm glad that we're doing it. But job creation is a sort of standard that is independent of thinking about the bigger challenges that we face as a society. And ultimately, we need to take on those challenges, and we need to do it in the way that we can from there. I want to say just a little bit about change, and then I want to focus a little bit more on the specifics of what has been done and what is being done, and sort of bring this back home again. In my mind, it's incredibly important to be able to distinguish between, on the one hand, incremental versus transformative change. We are, I think, very good at thinking about incremental change. Things change slowly over time. I get older every year, so it's harder for me to hike up the trail as I go down from there. But ultimately, and that sort of incremental change, I think, is a part of human life. We build things up slowly over time from there. And that's the way some things work. But one of the things that I think we understand, if we think about human systems, but particularly if we look at nature, that oftentimes incremental change is not as common as we think, and there's an awful lot of transformative change that takes place over time. And I want to give just a couple of examples, but I want you to sort of think about the power that is in there, from there. One of the examples that people cite regularly, since I was just talking about reinventing fire and thinking about what happens with our kind of industrial system and the energy system that's there, is what happened in the United States around the time that the U.S. entered into World War II. There was an absolutely dramatic change in what we did with our industrial system that all took place within 6 months. Some people have looked at this in depth. There's books been sort of written about that change. But essentially, within 6 months, we transitioned. Sorry, there's a llama going by in a truck. That's what I was expecting to see outside.
It's the luggage truck.
It's the luggage truck. Oh, of course. Where else would a llama be but in the luggage truck? Maybe that's transformative change. I'm not sure. You send a suitcase down and it comes back with a llama. What happened in the United States is essentially they took this auto building infrastructure and totally transformed it in order to build what was necessary for the war effort. And they did all of that in 6 months, in 6 months' time, essentially, from there. Everybody said there's no way that it can be done, and they did it anyway. If people who are sort of looking at the industrial infrastructure that we have in place now and say there's no way we could make enough solar panels, there's no way we could make enough wind turbines, we can't sort of change where we're at. There are great historical examples, I think, of how that dramatic transformative change takes place. For me, I think it's almost always the case that we have a tremendous amount to learn from looking at natural systems. And I think natural systems are largely systems where we see very dramatic transformative change. Sometimes there's a lot of destruction in that. Forest fires are very destructive things, but they also are renewing natural parts of the landscape, etc., from there. And we see a sort of total transformation of an ecosystem in a relatively short amount of time from there. And we can see the same thing in other places at other times as we begin to think about it from there. We need to keep in mind that change is not always slow and incremental. And oftentimes we think there's no way we could meet that grand challenge, but it's because we're sort of limited in the way that we're thinking about it. We need to sort of recognize the ability for things to change so quickly that it goes beyond what we can even think of along the way from there. I want to shift gears a little bit just looking at the clock, and as usual, I'm jabbering on more than I had sort of planned to from there, and to talk about it at a little bit more, at a different sort of level in terms of how we can think about sustainability and where it might be going, and I'm hoping I can erase that stuff off the chalkboard and go from there.
It's on the floor.
Ah, thank you. I do think it's important for us to think about sustainability at multiple levels. So there are the grand challenges, but there's also the things that happen along the way in order to get there. And in thinking about that, there's a couple of images that I want to sort of bring forward for you to think about, and then to get into some more specifics and ask you for specifics as you think about it as well from there. I'm not usually one that reads business books, and I don't necessarily recommend them to you as well, but there was a book that was written maybe a decade ago called Good to Great. And then some of you may know this, and then there was a smaller sort of piece of it that came Good to Great for the social sector that was sort of thinking about it for other things. So it's essentially about how organizations go from being good organizations to sort of transforming themselves along the way. And two of the concepts that came out of that book, which I think are really useful in thinking about this, are the concept of what Collins calls BHAGs, which for him are big, hairy, audacious goals. And in some ways, it's a way of coming back to the grand challenges. How do we set big, hairy, audacious goals from there? And the second concept, which I want to say more about in just a few minutes, is this notion of thinking about much of what we do as turning a flywheel. So keep those in mind, and I'll sort of return to them in just a second from there. Somebody asked before, who am I talking to? Am I talking to individuals? Are we talking to businesses? Are we talking to government along the way? And I do sort of think about what's happening here as taking place at multiple different levels. Part of that is thinking about this in terms of what it means for individuals and families. Part of this is thinking about it for organizations, and then more broadly thinking about it at the community or government scale from there. And I think it's not possible for us to sort of address this at only one level. We need to be thinking about it at multiple different levels, otherwise we won't won't be able to get where it is that we want to go with some of this. And so I want to say just a little bit about each of these, and then I want to be able to stop and take some questions and be able to engage you all a little bit more in thinking about where we're headed as we go forward. Wendell Berry wrote a wonderful little essay called Think Little. And it's sort of a nice contrast to what I was saying about the grand challenges that are there along the way. But he was particularly focused on the tendency that he saw in the environmental movement of that time to want to blame other people and to say other people need to do this or need to do that. We need our government to address climate change. We need the state of Washington to do something about forests along the way. And what Berry argued, and this is sort of consistent with all of his writing, if you see it, is that we need to start by thinking about ourselves. We need to start by thinking a little. Thinking about how we live our lives, thinking about what it is that we can do as individuals in order to sort of put our own house in order, if you will. That if you start by thinking little. And I think this is an aspect of sustainability that is really important to keep in mind as we think about it, is how does this take place on a personal level from there? How do I so organize my life that sustainability can be a sort of organizing principle for my own life along the way? What Berry did not mean, and what so much of what's happening, I think, today as we think about sustainability involved, is to say, I need to make sure that I always buy green products. There is something about our society that we like to respond to challenges by buying stuff. Never was this more evident, I think, than after September 11th, when our president so nicely said, what can we do to help? We should go shopping. And we should buy things. And these days, it's an incredible industry that's out there saying that you should buy the green dishwashing detergent, and you should buy your hybrid car, and you should buy these other things. And those are important decisions that we make. But I think it's really important that we not confuse that with thinking about sustainability as a lens for looking at our own lives. It's not just about what we buy. And it's absolutely crucial to understand that there is no way that we will buy our way out of any of the grand challenges of our time from there. That doesn't mean that our buying decisions aren't important. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't think about them in that terms, but it's got to be about something more than that. And if you think about the areas that we had up there with some of the grand challenges, thinking about your own food purchases, which I always suggest to people as a starting point from there. The whole local vor movement that's out there these days is important for people, I think, thinking about, do you know where your food comes from? But it's also just, it becomes a way of beginning to think about what is the impact that comes from my consumption of food? How can I begin to think about my own energy challenges and what can go along with that from there? How can I understand where I fit into my community and where I head out from there? In thinking about how this sort of works itself out from there, I do think there's a sort of a tension between the sort of technological and non-technological ways of addressing a lot of these. And I think that's part of the situation that comes back to any of the energy stuff that we're there. I want to stop for just a minute. I'm going to give some more examples as we go through from there. But what I want to ask, and I want to look a little bit at Holden Village here too, is, let me just stop and take questions for just a minute, and then I'll go into another piece of it from there. Are there other things that, from stuff I've said, that sort of you're worried about?
I'm just sitting here thinking that half of the people in the United States don't believe any of those problems are problems. Mm-hmm. I just go, then I just kind of give up.
Then you give up because you see the challenges that other people don't see those as real problems.
I don't see how we could ever come together to address them in time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it comes back to this question of we may not be able to see where it is, how we're going to be able to do it, but we still need to sort of be taking those actions at the steps along the way in order to be able to get there. I wouldn't encourage you to spend a lot of time trying to convince other people that those are challenges that are there. I think the challenge for us is largely to figure out how can we work in our little ways to begin to move forward in the point from there.
Well, I think we're living during a time when it's sort of like, I think about the game of Monopoly and how we all feel when we're playing Monopoly and somebody ends up with all of the houses and all of the money and you feel like quitting. Well, that's what life in the United States is becoming. A few people have grabbed, it's just like playing Monopoly. We all get greedy when we play Monopoly, and there are people that are playing Monopoly for real, and we have a very uneven distribution of wealth and resources in our country. It's been getting worse for the last 40 years, and a lot of people, like we would feel in Monopoly, when you're losing, you want to quit. Mm-hmm. And that is not sustainable. We need to do something about that, or we're in big, big trouble.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and you're sort of pointing at the economic piece of it, but it's sort of true in lots of places that we feel like we want to quit along the way. And it's particularly important that we don't quit and that we find ways of sort of working at the individual parts of it from there. And maybe let me just take this to the next step and then we can go from there. I think the individual level I talked about before, I think we tend to want to see this because they're grand challenges is something that we need everybody to be a part of and we need to sort of work at in order to be able to solve it from there. To me, the most interesting work that's happening in our society right now is at that sort of central organizational level and thinking about what can happen with a particular organization and what can begin to move things in the right direction. And I do think Holden Village is an interesting example to think about in terms of what is happening here, but also how that can be a springboard for doing more in other places. I said before that there's the BHAGs and the flywheel, turning the flywheel along the way, and I didn't fill out where that is. Setting big goals, but then understanding that oftentimes the work that is being done feels insignificant, but it's you need to have sort of the faith that it is moving in the right direction. At our place every fall, we do an apple cidering day. And what we do is we borrow from some friends a 100-year-old cider press and haul the thing over. It takes many people to just get the thing lifted into the pickup and back out again. And then gather together many different families that bring apples from all over the place. And we spend a Sunday afternoon dumping apples into a stock tank, trying to keep the children from falling in after the apples as they go in, taking those apples out, putting them through this cider press and pressing out, usually 50 to 100 gallons of cider. But that cider press is this big, heavy thing with a huge crank that's on it. And on the other side is a wheel that's about this big around, this big, huge old flywheel along the way. And when you try to get started from there, it takes a tremendous amount of effort to move that flywheel a small amount from there. And oftentimes we have more than one person that's trying to get the thing started as it goes around. But what you find is that as you gain just a little bit of momentum, the flywheel starts turning faster. And as you get that going faster and faster, that flywheel becomes this tremendous force to keep things accelerating as it goes forward from there. And that's the image that Jim Collins has in mind in thinking about an organization, but it's also, I think, what we have to keep in mind when we think about working on sustainability. So much of what we're doing is trying to get that flywheel started turning. If we can get that going further, we're working hard to turn a small amount, there will be a buildup of momentum. And I believe we're beginning to see this now, that flywheel begins to turn faster and faster, and that momentum sort of moves us in the direction of that transformative change instead of the incremental change. That you begin to turn it just a little bit, and then it begins to take off and go in a new direction from there.
You meant when you were talking about food systems, I challenge my congregation, I have people here, every one of us knows a young adult who's chosen to do local food production as a career, the new young farmers. It's called Generation O for organic. They're everywhere, these kids in their 20s and 30s, growing food on a small scale. It's a huge movement in this country.
And that's, I think, I would add to that, Wendell Berry, one of the things he spoke about was supporting local. He's very much into local economy. And you said, you know, we're loyal to places. We're not loyal to governments. We're loyal to places, to mountain ranges, to swamps that we know and love. And that's where it starts, I think, in developing those local loyalties. And the one thing I wanted to say real on the top of that, I think it's very empowering every time you talk about incremental change. Every time you speak out and say something positive, say something like you're doing this morning, every time I do it, I feel empowered. Mm-hmm. And I remember Robert Reich, who was the Secretary of Labor for Clinton, mm-hmm. said he was battling hard for a Medicare bill, and he came out after losing this battle and being utterly disappointed, and there was nobody on the streets, nobody there. And he said the silence was deafening. And he said, if people need to get out and express their voices because it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. You know, and I believe that.
Also, when you talk about the organizational thing, things, I think we're starting to see some things like some of the economic things that make recycling, and it fits and starts, recycling logical and starts affecting people's behavior. And just a simple thing, and out here maybe everyone does it, but having everything you want recycled being able to be put in one mm-hmm. container. Mm-hmm. And you make it easier for people, and you make it cost more if you don't do it. And suddenly, I mean, and I think those are the sorts of things that we have to discover, the things that do make the flywheel mm-hmm. start to go.
Yeah, and so, I mean, for me, it's thinking about how can we think about the big challenges, but then how can we take those small actions that begin to spin the flywheel along the way. Let me say just a little bit about what's happening at Luther College, because it's what sort of I work on a regular basis, and then I want to say something about Holden Village before we wrap up, and I'm just trying to be sensitive to where we are time-wise. At Luther, and this is happening everywhere, I'm very involved in the sort of movement on sustainability and higher education. There are thousands of universities across the country that are working in that way. And I think sometimes we get depressed at what's happening at the government level, or we know lots of individuals that don't take all of this seriously, but trying to find those places where there are good things happening from there. At Luther in 2008, we decided that we needed to make sustainability a priority in what we were doing, and it comes back to setting big, hairy, audacious goals. Luther set a goal to cut its carbon footprint, to all of the carbon emissions that came out from the college, by 50%. At the time, we had absolutely no idea how we would go about achieving that along the way, but it became an important piece of sort of thinking about what we were doing. We set a goal to get 35% of all the food that was served on campus to come from local farmers, to sort of have that identifiable connection. We set goals in terms of cutting our water usage, our waste, and trying to figure out what it was there. I think we can say in every single case, we didn't have any idea how we were going to go about meeting those goals from there. What has happened in the last several years is it focused discussion, it focused work, it focused resources on addressing those things by sort of setting that big goal and then slowly working in different ways to get there. We expect that we'll hit that 50% goal within 2 years on our campus. In terms of cutting our carbon footprint, we're at about 40% right now. One of the things that's happening on our campus this week is there's a 280-kilowatt solar photovoltaic array that is being put up. It will provide the electricity for a residence hall that houses about 100 people. That residence hall gets all of its heating and cooling from geothermal, a system that was put in place before. So we believe that those 100 students living there will have sort of a net zero energy facility in terms of where they're living along the way.
All of our churches should do that.
All of our churches should do that. The things that we keep in mind is people say, you could never do that, it's too expensive. When they looked at the geothermal and looked at the extra price tag and they said it's too expensive, it paid for itself within a year. The photovoltaics are being done in a way in cooperation with a local investor. The biggest part of that story, I think, with the photovoltaics is not that this is some magical thing, but it's a piece of the puzzle that keeps us moving forward. And most importantly there, I think if you asked anyone a year ago, nobody would have thought that was possible. Nobody was even thinking about doing it. And a year later, it's up and running, and it's a system that's sort of in place from there. We expect by the end of this year to have hit that 35% goal for local food along the way. We're trying to look at how we can sort of shift things along the way. Is it easy? No. But it's sort of trying to understand that process of transforming an organization. Dale is involved with an outreach project here where they're working with local congregations. I think congregations are this amazing opportunity for thinking about the possibilities that can happen with transforming organizations that gradually spread out much more. Thinking about energy, thinking about food, thinking about how we work to change the economic system and the different things that are there from there. There are the possibilities that are there. There are the positive stories for change that are out there along the way. As we are here at Holden Village, I think it's a great opportunity for us to think about how this becomes a springboard for sustainability in our own lives and our own communities as well from there. I like to think about this in terms of the what ifs when you think about Holden Village being transferred out of here. What if garbology was a household word and everyone sorted their own garbage and was as mindful of what we throw away as we are at Holden Village? What if everyone knew where their electricity came from? What if we all took a moment every day, as I think I've seen everyone here in the village do, to stop and appreciate the beauty that surrounds us from there? What if we made community a priority everywhere, the way that we do at Holden Village? What if hilarity were a core value in all communities, not just at Holden Village? How could we think about that as a sort of springboard for transforming where we're going? What are your what-ifs, sort of in thinking about what you think of from Holden Village? Are there things that you can think of that provide that sort of springboard out from here?
Well, what if less really is more, mm-hmm. in terms of the stuff? I think spiritually we have to work at getting past seeing that as deprivation, mm-hmm. that less stuff is freeing and liberating, and there's much joy in living close to the earth.
Absolutely.
My question is urgency. Is that important, to have a feeling of urgency?
It's a yes and no. And so certainly many of the challenges that we face are very urgent challenges. Every day that things go on without us doing something different about the question of climate change is something that's lost along the way. But oftentimes urgency sort of pushes us rapidly to either panic or kind of despair. And I don't think we can afford either of those. So I think having a sense of urgency, but also having sort of a creative tension with having patience and having faith. Having faith that there will be that sort of transformative change that we need. But we can't afford to sit and do nothing, but there's got to be kind of a creative tension where it doesn't take us into panic and it doesn't take us into saying, it's too late. I got to give up from there on the way. Yeah?
How do I feel about my job in the retail sector that depends on people just consuming and reconsuming and rebuying the same stuff they bought a few years ago? Mm-hmm.
I mean, if the question is how do you feel about it, I think that's a question that only you can answer.
Yes.
But I do think we need to transform our retail sector. We need to transform our economy. There are things that people can buy that are renewing and regenerative, and we need to make sure that we think in terms of how everything that we do sort of fits into that picture. But I also think that there's no doubt in my mind that this picture, this sort of vision for the future, is fundamentally one where we buy less stuff. I don't think there's any other way around that. How do we think about transforming our economy so that more people make their livelihood, make their living, doing something other than buying and selling stuff, I think will be one of the big questions.
Well, the fact that we live in a world where Apple Computer is perhaps the most successful, most highly valued corporation in the world right now, and they do all of the things that we should not be doing. Mm-hmm. So that kind of tells you what we're facing.
Mm-hmm. And the issue, too, a lot of that is cheap stuff. People bought things that would last longer, you would pay more. And, you know, you might earn just as much money retailing, but then they would have things that lasted longer. Mm-hmm. The most expensive thing you can buy is a cheap piece of equipment. Mm-hmm.
because it costs you more in the long term from there. Let's
get over here.
That's an interesting point. We've significantly reduced our consumption of coal in the last 10 years. One of the reasons is that natural gas prices have dropped 60%.
Mm-hmm.
But then the question is, Montana and Wyoming have a 50-year supply of coal. Where is that coal going to go? Mm-hmm. It's going to go to China. It's going to go to India.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is that a good thing?
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, that's... right. I mean, so we've cut off our coal, and I haven't said much of anything about the international scope. I think there's really good historical evidence to think that if we can dramatically change things in the U.S., places, other parts of the world will follow.
We're trying to deal with that. I'm sorry, Jim.
Go ahead.
Well, we're trying to deal with that issue in Bellingham, my hometown, because we the coal trains come right through there to the port. And so the issue is that first stopping it there, but not just diverting it to Mount Vernon or Seattle, but trying to address moving from the specific, I don't want it here, to I don't want it at all, is a big challenge. And that issue comes up front and center all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Chinese economy is very much dependent upon selling stuff to us. And if we can transform where we're doing, I think China will follow us. I realize I'm over time. Let me just end with just something very quick to think about from here. I think this stuff can be really depressing. But I think there's also a sense in which there's a tremendous hope that's to be found in places like Holden, in connecting to other people that care about this, but also in working for change in the places where you're able to do that along the way. I said before, I look ahead to 2050. It's not 50 years out, but it's not that far. For me, here's why. I think that I may live to see 2050, but I won't live very far beyond that. I have a tremendous amount of faith that the world will look radically different by 2050 than it does now. And I think it's up to all of us what that world looks like along the way. I want to leave you with four questions. I said before that we started with that as we think about this in terms of where it goes from there. It's also 2050 will be the year when my daughter is the same age that I am now. And sort of thinking about that and what that means. So four questions as you begin to think about all of this stuff. What kind of world do you want the children of 2050 to inherit? What will it take to create that world? And what can be done now to contribute to that process? The big question I think all of us have to ask ourselves is, what will you do to lead the sustainability revolution in your community? What's one thing that you can do to be a part of that along the way? And I want to leave you with one final question. It comes from the poet Mary Oliver by way of my friend Jim Farrell, who teaches at St. Olaf College, has been very involved in stuff that's happening there, wrote a wonderful book called The Nature of College, sort of looking at what happens on a college campus and what can happen from there. Jim has all of his classes read the Mary Oliver poem, A Summer's Day, and claims that all of his classes are ultimately about this one question, but I think it's the question for all of us. The poem ends with this question. What will you do with your one wild and precious life? To me, that's the question for all of us. And it's the question for sustainability, is thinking about that. What will you do with your one wild and precious life? I hope you use part of it to work for sustainability. Thanks.
Thanks so much.